There was another wave of violence across Iraq this week. 550 people have been killed in attacks there this month alone. 550. It has been 10 years since the war started, and as far as many Americans are concerned, it ended in December 2011 when the last U.S. combat troops left. Rajiv Chandrasekaran was the Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post in 2003 and 2004. This year, he set out to find the Iraqis who worked for the Post during the war who are now living in America. One of them is Omar Fekeke. He worked as an interpreter and correspondent for the Post in Baghdad from 2003 to 2006. Today, he lives in Maryland, where he's an assignment editor for Radio Sawa. That's a U.S.-funded station that beams pop music and news across the Arab world. Rajiv and Omar join us now from Washington. And for both of you, first of all, I'm wondering, what are you thinking today as you see all this violence in Iraq? Omar, let's start with you.
I believe many Iraqis think it's pure politics now. It's the different political groups fighting over power, and that's igniting a lot of violence in the streets. Unfortunately, it's the kind of violence we really went through in 2006 and 2007, the civil war, which I call civil war. But it's taken a toll on the Iraqis more these days, because we, for a while, for a few years, we thought everything was over, the civil war was over, and now we're trying to rebuild Iraq. But unfortunately, politics is not giving us a chance to do that.
Would you call it a civil war now?
Not yet, but definitely it's sectarian fighting.
Rajiv, what about you? You know, 10 years later, the idea that we're still having 550 people killed so far this month, it just seems incredible.
Well, you know, the difference, just picking up from where Omar left off, the difference between the way the Iraqis see it and the way the Americans see it is profound. Most Americans think, look, this war is over. We fixed the mess we created there after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein.
And we withdrew.
And Iraqis know that the war is not over. And, you know, fundamentally, the deep-seated problems there have not been fixed.
And we should say that there aren't people like you there anymore. There are not nearly as many American journalists who are covering this.
Just a small handful. Largely, it's Iraqi reporters, some of them very capable, some of them individuals who've been trained working side by side with Western correspondents. But the size of the press corps really does reflect the diminished level of interest out in the outside world on the Iraq story, as well as the very real financial pressures that are buffeting the news business today.
Well, and even back then, 10 years ago, American journalists had to rely heavily on Iraqi translators, not just to translate, but to do a lot of the reporting. I want to get to you, Omar, and how the two of you came to be working for the same paper. Tell us about how you got this job at The Washington Post in 2003.
It was a pure coincidence, actually. I was trying to get a phone to call my relatives in London to tell them that we survived the war, and the only way to do that was to try to get one of the journalists who were covering Iraq to lend me the phone. But a few minutes later, I found this foreign journalist, who happened to be Maribeth Sheridan of the Post, trying to converse with Iraqis, but they didn't speak English. She didn't speak Arabic, and I volunteered to translate. And 45 minutes later, she introduced me to Rajiv, who actually offered me the job on the spot as a translator.
And this was just a few days after that famous scene where the statue of Saddam Hussein was pulled down in Baghdad.
9 days after that, yeah.
Omar, what drew you to work for an American media outlet during that time in Iraq? I mean, did you just need a job, or did you feel some need to tell Americans what was going on in the war?
I remember when Rajiv offered me to come work as a translator, my first sentence was, no, I'm not looking for a job, which, thinking about it now, was very stupid of me. But I did not need a job at the time. I knew we needed someone to tell the story. We were desperate to tell the outside world, not only the Americans, the outside world, what was happening in Iraq. And to me, that was the best way I can help my country and the world tell the story. And I became fascinated with the whole process, and I was never able to get out of journalism since.
And Rajiv, what do you think that you and your readers got out of having Iraqis do so much of the reporting on the war?
Well, look, going to a place like Baghdad as a foreigner, trying to make sense of not just the violence of the day, but the broader political, religious, cultural underpinnings of the story. It's impossible, or it's near impossible to do as somebody just arriving there fresh for the first time. I mean, it's like a, you know, somebody showing up on a completely different planet. And so you need trusted local guides to help you navigate this, to help you understand, to help you get through the door to see people, to secure interviews. And so we needed these Iraqi partners. They were indispensable teammates. Their instincts helped us see the broader, deeper story. They saw things and understood things we never could have done by ourselves. They allowed us to talk to people we couldn't have talked to, and their instincts, quite frankly, saved our lives on multiple occasions.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran was the Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post in 2003 and 2004. We're also talking with Omar Fakeki, who worked as an interpreter and correspondent for the Post in Baghdad from 2003 to 2006. He is living in the U.S. now, and the adjustment for Iraqis coming to America is not always easy. We're going to talk about that after a break.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, protecting drivers and their families with insurance coverage for over 75 years. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
Welcome back to our conversation with Rajiv Chandrasekaran and Omar Fakeki. Rajiv was Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post in 2003 and 2004. Omar worked as an interpreter for the Post reporters. He was one of more than two dozen Iraqis hired by the paper, and he was the first of them to come to the United States. And Omar, you went to journalism school. You wanted to go back to Iraq and reopen your uncle's newspaper, which Saddam Hussein had closed. Why didn't that happen?
Actually, when people ask me about that, I always remember when I left Baghdad to come to the States, I didn't even pack all my clothes. I left some of them in my house in Baghdad just because I knew I was coming back. I didn't think of anything else to do other than help Iraqi journalism and reopen my uncle's newspaper. Hmm. A few months before graduation, as I was wrapping up and planning for a return to Iraq, my family told me about the threats they've been receiving since I left the States, about getting killed or myself.
You were on a list.
I was on a list. I didn't know that until my family realized that I was really going back because I was talking about tickets and dates of going back to Iraq, and then I was told, look, a few weeks or months ago, we realized that your name was on a to-kill list, and this is what you should know. We received threats. Either we'll be killed or you'll be killed if you go back to Iraq, just because the terrorists think that you've been trained as a spy to go back to Iraq, is very silly.
So you applied for asylum here in the
then
U.S.?
I applied for asylum.
You are now an American citizen. What did it mean to you to become one?
Oh, the world. I mean, for the past 10 years, I did not even feel that I belong to a place because the Iraq I know has disappeared. The new Iraq has rejected me and forced me out.
Rejected
and
you?
And I've been totally did. I mean, when you get threats, when you get shot at, when on your way to work or back home, that means the country has rejected you because you can't live like this. When I became a citizen here in the United States, that was a moment when I felt, okay, I belong to this place. This place will protect me and my family. It meant the world to me. There are no words that I know in English that can describe that feeling other than I go to sleep with a mind full of hope for myself and my family.
Rajiv, there were many reporters, Iraqi reporters who worked for the Post in Baghdad. Many of them have come to the United States. Tell us about their experiences you've written about so extensively in the Washington Post.
many of them started to come 4 or 5 years ago, some a little bit more recently than that. We probably now have about 18 of our staff members plus their families living in various parts of the United States, not just in the Washington area, but out in Portland, Oregon, in Phoenix, Arizona, San Diego, Toledo, Ohio.
And doing all kinds of different jobs. I mean, from airline mechanic to what Omar is doing at Radio Sawa.
Indeed. And some of them are prospering. Others of them are having challenges finding work. The experience kind of runs the gamut.
Well, there's the case of Nasir Nouri, who got into credit card debt here in the U.S. He thought everything was going well. You describe all the things he had purchased, and he was so excited to go out to dinner with his family. And then next thing you know, he's got $15,000 of debt and he has to cut up all his cards. And he says this incredible quote, "I thought I knew everything about America, but there are ambushes here I never expected."
And that plays off of Nasir's great resourcefulness in Baghdad. I mean, he was a guy who had a sixth sense of violence emerging on the streets, and on numerous occasions saved the lives of Washington Post personnel just with his quick thinking. Yet he comes here, and in some ways, it's a very uniquely American story, right? I mean, how many millions of Americans are also in credit card debt? He comes here, thinks he knows how to navigate through the country, goes to the fragrance counter at Macy's to buy a bottle of Polo cologne. The woman behind the counter urges him to apply for a credit card, and that one credit application leads to other offers coming in the mail.
Yeah.
He signs them and ultimately finds himself in this big hole. So, in one hand, I look at this and say, "Oh, you know, this is dreadful." On the other hand, you know, it shows perhaps the degree to which it maybe not in the best of ways that our Iraqis are sort of assimilating. They're learning both what's good and bad about the United States.
Omar, do you think you're ever going to go back to Iraq?
Oh, totally. I have to go back to Iraq. As I tell Rajiv and other friends, this time when I go back to Iraq, I'm going to have an even bigger responsibility, because now I'm going to be the American who is back to help Iraqis. And then my countrymen, Iraqis and American, funny to say that, will realize that we can coexist and we can help each other. And it doesn't have to be a failure, as we witnessed in the last 10 years.
Rajiv, finally back to you. Why did you think you wanted to write this and go check in with all of these people that you worked with? What message did you want to get out?
I was asked several months ago to write a Iraq 10-year anniversary story. And I didn't want to do the standard piece, just going to Baghdad and write, you know, wither the country and write about the violence. And I'd formed these amazing relationships with the men and women I had hired. And I had lost touch with many of those who had worked for me. And so I wanted to go and see them. Part of it was a personal journey to understand how their lives had been transformed. And I see a broader message in this, in that we as Americans need to spend a little more time looking at the legacy of the Iraq War. It was a war that we started. There's a real human cost to this, not just in the United States, but over there as well. And my attention drifted, and I wanted to at least spend a little time returning my gaze to the country. And I do hope Iraqis like Omar, I should say now Iraqi Americans like Omar, who have come to this country, who have built successful lives for themselves, do go back and visit and bring back some of what they've learned over here. I mean, if guys like Omar can go back, maybe they can accomplish what the United States military and the U.S. government so profoundly failed to do in trying to rebuild that country. And maybe if Iraq is to really be rebuilt and to get back up on its feet, it's going to require Iraqis to do it. And Iraqis, some of them who have learned a thing or two outside the country, who've come to this country and have acquired skills and built new lives, but decide to go back and help their people.
Rajiv Chandrasekharan, former Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. We've also been speaking with Omar Fakeki, who worked as an interpreter for The Post from 2003 to 2006. He's now an American citizen working for Radio Sawa outside Washington. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you for taking the time to talk about this subject.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So what do you think? Should there be more reporting about Iraq in the U.S., even though the combat troops have left? Or have you had enough coverage of Iraq? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Cancer Center at Beth Israel Deaconess, where researchers are working to discover new ways of diagnosing and treating a variety of cancers. BIDMC.org/cancercenter. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Radio Shack.